thing about the man she was involved with? He asks. Only that he was married, Feather says, and was apparently a real bastard. Pursued her, pursued her, pursued her, then dropped her like a hot potato. Won't leave his wife, no way, no how. And I'll tell you, that all sounded much too familiar. But Merritt didn't say who the man was? She didn't tell, and neither did I, Feather says. We were there to commiserate, not confess. Did she say if the man she was seeing was at the wedding? Nick asks. At the... No. She lives in Manhattan. Why would... Are you thinking she was seeing a married man at the wedding, and he was the one who killed her? Nick needs to redirect. What happened when you left the pool house? We decided to walk back to the main house, Feather says. And we happened to cross Tag and Thomas and their bottle of Black Barrel. Did they seem surprised to see you two? Nick asks. Feather tilts her head. Did they? I don't remember. Tag asked if we were up for a nightcap. We said yes. So you're sitting around under the tent drinking rum, and what happens? Nick asks. What do you think happens? Feather asks. We get drunk. She pauses. Drunker. Was Merritt drinking? I assume so, Feather says. Don't quote me on that, because remember, she had a queasy stomach. After a while, Thomas's wifey called him upstairs, and I figured the party was breaking up. But Tag is a night owl, and he seemed game to keep going a while longer, and Merritt asked for water. I got it for her, actually. You got Merritt a glass of water? Nick says. Feather nods. Did you put ice in the water? Nick asks. Feather's eyes roll skyward, as if the answer to that question is written on the ceiling. I can't recall. I'm sorry, is that important? Did anything else happen while you were inside getting the water? He asks. Did you see anyone? Do anything? Feather nods. I took a piss. You went to the bathroom, Nick says. Was that before you poured the water or after? Feather stares at him. After, she says. I left the water on the counter. I mean, I didn't bring it into the loo with me. But you didn't see anyone else in the kitchen? Nick asks. No. Did you hear anyone? No, Feather says. Fan was on. In very posh houses, you know, they don't listen to one another tinkle. No one followed you in from outside? Nick asks. No, Feather says. And when you brought Merritt the water, did she drink it? Nick asks. Drank it down like she'd eaten a pound of rock salt. Do you remember clearing her glass? Nick asks. Because the water glass wasn't on the table this morning, but the shot glasses were. Feather shakes her head. I've got no memory of clearing the glass or not clearing the glass. If I had to guess, I'd say I left it there, thinking the housekeeper would get it in the morning. Nick makes a note. Housekeeper? And how did the party finally break up? Nick asks. We ran through the bottle of rum, Feather says. Tag said he was going to his study for another. Right after he left, Merritt said she was going to bed. So I was in the tent by myself for a while. But then I decided I'd better skedaddle. I didn't want to stay up late drinking with just Tag. Why not? It wouldn't look good, Feather says. If Greer caught us... Feather pauses. I'm terrified of that woman. Are you? Everyone is terrified of her, Feather says. She says one thing, but you can just tell by looking at her that in her mind she's thinking something else. Novelists are notorious liars, you know. Are they? Nick asks. Aren't they? Feather says. They lie for a living. They make up stories. So it stands to reason that this tendency runs over into their personal lives. Nick is intrigued by this answer. Did you see Greer around at all, even for an instant after the party? Did you see her in the kitchen pouring herself a glass of champagne? No, Feather says. She gasps. Why? Do you think Greer had something to do with what happened? You didn't see her? Nick asks. Feather shakes her head. Did you see Merritt again that night? No, Feather says. So the last time you saw Merritt was when she left the tent saying she was going to bed? Correct. At any point during the night, did Merritt cut her foot? Nick asks. Cut her foot? Feather says. No. Was she wearing shoes when you were doing your stealthy hunting? Yes, Feather says. Silver sandals. Gorgeous. Merritt said she had gotten them for free from the company, and I asked if she could get me a pair for free, and she asked what size I wore, and I said 10 and a half, and she said, done. Feather's eyes start to water. She really was a lovely girl. Yes, Nick says. I'm sure she was. He writes, no cut, sandals. He knows there were silver sandals on the scene, under the tent, which Merritt must have left behind when she went for the kayak ride. Nick finally feels like he can see what happened last night, except for a few critical details. Okay, so when you skedaddled, where did you go? Did you call a taxi and go back to your inn? Mm-hmm, Feather says. I'm sorry, Nick says. I need you to give me a yes or no answer. Feather hesitates. Okay, then, Nick thinks. Here it is. Feather? Yes, she says. Yes, I did. And what time was that? Nick asks. Couldn't tell you. But it was late, he says. Feather shrugs. Nick locks eyes with Feather and gives her his best smile. Nick's sister, Helena, calls this smile the kill, because it usually gets him whatever he's after. And Feather succumbs to it. She cocks an eyebrow. Are you single? She asks. Because if you are, I could be convinced to stay another night. Did you call the taxi right away? Nick asks. Or did you stay in the tent? Or did you do something else? Something else, Feather says. The manager of your inn, Nick says, told our officer that you returned to the hotel at 5:15 this morning. And we have a time of death for Ms. Monaco somewhere between 2:45 and 3:45. Working backward, then, she likely entered the water between 2:30 and 3:30. Now, if you didn't reach your inn until 5:15, the manager is mistaken, Feather says. It was earlier than 5. Hours earlier. But you said only a moment ago that you didn't know what time it was, Nick says. Well, I can bloody well tell you it was earlier than 5 o'clock, Feather says. We can easily check the security cameras, Nick says. Feather hoots. That place does not have security cameras, she says. You're trying to trick me. They had a break-in last year, Nick says. Nothing was taken, but Miss Branigan, who runs the inn, was understandably skittish, so she installed cameras. Nick closes his notebook, grabs his pen, and stands. I'll send Officer Lucklow out to request the camera footage. He turns, wondering how many steps away he'll get. 2 steps, as it turns out. Wait, Feather says. Just wait. Do you want to change your answer? Nick says. Yes, Feather says. Do you have a cigarette? Quit 5 years ago, Nick says. Saved my own life. It's a filthy habit. Filthy, Feather agrees. But sometimes nothing else will do. I have to agree with you there, Nick says. He sits back down. I do sometimes bum one when I've been drinking bourbon. You're human, then, Feather says. She tears up. And I'm human, too. That's exactly right, Nick says. You're human, and human beings make mistakes and act in all kinds of ways we shouldn't. He pauses and very slowly opens his notebook. Now, why don't you tell me what happened? You didn't call a taxi, did you?
No, Feather says. No, I didn't. I went into the house and fell asleep.
Nick drops his pen. Fell asleep?
More like passed out, Feather says.
You expect me to believe that? Nick says.
It's the truth, Feather says.
Nick stands up. You were one of the last people to see Merritt Monaco alive. Unless you can come up with a taxi driver who will vouch for picking you up before 2:45, I have you at the scene at the time of death. You were also the one who brought Ms. Monaco the water, which was the last thing she consumed before she died. Do you know what kind of trouble that puts you in, Ms. Dale?
I stayed at the Winbury's house, Feather says, because I was waiting for someone.
Waiting for who? Nick says. He tries to sort through the major players. Mr. Winbury having an affair with Merritt. Shooter Uxley in love with the bride. Who was Featherly Dale waiting for in the middle of the night? Feather's full-on crying now. Nick can't decide which way to go. Should he raise his voice and play the bully? No, he thinks. That only works on TV. In real life, what works is patience and kindness. Nick grabs the box of tissues they keep in the interview room for just this sort of occasion. He puts it on the table, plucks out a tissue, hands it to Feather, then eases down into his seat. Who were you waiting for, Feather? He asks, as gently as he can. Who?
Thomas, Feather says.
Thomas? Nick thinks. Who's Thomas? Then he remembers. Thomas is Benji's brother. Thomas Winbury? Nick says. Are you involved with Thomas Winbury romantically? Married man, he thinks. Tag. Way, way too old. They were there to commiserate, not confess.
Was, Feather says. But then he broke things off in May.
She stops to pluck another tissue out of the box and blow her nose.
When his wife got pregnant. He said he couldn't see me anymore. He told me not to come to the wedding. He said if I came to the wedding, he'd kill me. Those were his exact words.
Nick's thoughts are hopping now. Like father, like son. Thomas was involved with Feather but broke it off when he found out Abby was pregnant. Thomas tells Feather not to come to the wedding, threatens her. Maybe he thinks she'll tell Abby about the affair. Do you think Thomas meant it? Nick says. People say, I'm going to kill you all the time. Too much for my taste. Or do you think he actually tried to kill you? There was nothing in the shot glasses. Nothing in the bottle. The water glass. Let's go back, Nick says. When you went into the kitchen to get water for Merritt, you said everyone was still back at the table, correct? Feather pauses.
Yes.
And there was no one in the kitchen, he asks. You're sure you didn't see Greer? I know you're terrified of her, but you can tell me the truth.
No, Feather says, I did not see Greer.
And you used the restroom after you poured the water? Nick says. How long were you in the bathroom?
Couple minutes, Feather says. The usual amount of time. But I did try to primp a bit as well.
So let's say 5 minutes. Sound fair?
Fair.
Plenty of time for Thomas to sneak in and drop a Mickey in the water glass. Or for Greer to do the same. But, Nick thinks, Merritt wasn't poisoned, just sedated. Which leads Nick back to the father, Tag Winbury. Tag could have doctored the water before he took Merritt out on the kayak. Then, when she fell overboard, she would have been more likely to drown. What about the cut on her foot? Maybe she cut it on a shell on the ocean floor when she fell off the kayak? But there was blood in the sand. If Feather is telling the truth, and Merritt was wearing sandals earlier in the night, then she must have cut her foot after she got back from the kayak ride. Could she have cut her foot on the beach before climbing into the kayak? But there was no blood in the kayak. Unless Tag had washed it off. But if he was going to do that, why not tie the kayak back up? Ugh! Nick feels the answer is right there. He just can't see it. He smiles at Feather again and says, I'll be back in 2 shakes. Nick steps outside the interview room to call the chief. Talk to Thomas, the brother, he says. Karen. A knock at the door wakes Karen up. Karen looks over to Bruce and finds him asleep and snoring aggressively. Another knock. Then a voice. Betty? Mac? It's Celeste. Karen swings her feet to the floor and carefully stands up. She still feels no pain, which is odd. She opens the door to see her sad, beautiful daughter standing before her, wearing the pale pink dress with the rope detail that she was supposed to travel in tomorrow. She's holding her yellow paisley duffel bag.
"Oh, my poor, poor bug,"
Karen says. She gathers Celeste up in her arms.
"I am so sorry, sweetheart. So, so sorry about Merritt."
"It's my fault," Celeste says.
"She died because of me."
Karen recognizes this response as an opening for a longer conversation. She glances back at Bruce. He's still sawing logs, as they say. She knows she should wake him up. He will want to see Celeste, but she senses that Celeste needs a confidant, and there are some things that men just don't understand. Karen grabs her cane, steps out into the hallway, and closes the bedroom door behind her.
"Where shall we go?"
Celeste leads her to the end of the hall where there is a glassed-in sun porch that is quiet and unoccupied. Karen negotiates the one step down, holding on to Celeste's arm. Celeste leads Karen over to a sofa with bright yellow-orange cushions, the color of marigolds. Karen takes a moment to admire the room. The floor is herringboned brick, covered with seagrass area rugs. The perimeter of the room is lined with lush potted plants, philodendron, ferns, spider plants, a row of five identical topiary trees trimmed to look like globe lamps. From the ceiling hang blown glass spheres swirling with a rainbow of color. Karen becomes mesmerized for a second by the spheres. They look as delicate as soap bubbles. Celeste follows her gaze and says, "Apparently these were an obsession of Greer's the year she wrote A Murder in Murano. Murano is an island near Venice where they make glass. I had to look it up when Benji told me that."
"Oh," Karen says.
The room has enormous windows that look down over the round rose garden.
"There is no end to the wonders of this house."
"Well," Celeste says, but nothing follows, and Karen can't tell if she's agreeing or disagreeing. She sits next to Karen on the cheerful sofa.
"I decided last night that I wasn't going to marry Benji."
"I know," Karen says.
"How?" Celeste whispers. "How did you know?"
"I'm your mother," Karen says. She could tell Celeste about the dream with the strange hotel and how, in that dream, Celeste was lost. She could tell Celeste that she woke up so certain marrying Benji was the wrong thing for Celeste to do that she got out of bed and went looking for her. But she had found Bruce and Tag instead, and learned something she could have lived the rest of her days without knowing. She could even tell Celeste about her visit to the psychic, Catherine Randall, who had predicted that Celeste's love life would enter a state of chaos.
"But there's nothing either one of us can do about it."
Instead, Karen lets those three words suffice. She is Celeste's mother. It's suddenly clear that Karen's remaining time on Earth matters. There are so many moments of her life that will be overlooked or forgotten. Locking her keys in her car outside of Jabberwocky in downtown Easton. Having her credit card declined at Wegmans. Peeing behind a tree at Hackett's Park when she was pregnant with Celeste. Beating her best time in the 200-meter butterfly in the biggest meet of the year against Parkland when she was a senior. Nearly choking on a cherry lifesaver during a game of kickball when she was 10 years old. Sneaking out to the eighth hole of the Northampton Country Club with Bruce during her prom. Those moments had seemed important to Karen at the time, but then they vanished, evaporating to join the gray mist of her past. However, what Karen says to Celeste here and now will last. Celeste will remember her words for the rest of her life, she is sure of this, and so she has to take care.
"When you met Benji," Karen says, "we were very excited. Your father and I have been so happy together. We wanted you to find someone. We wanted you to have what we have."
Celeste lays her head in Karen's lap, and Karen strokes her hair.
Not everyone is like you,
Celeste says.
Not everyone gets that lucky on the first try. Or ever.
Celeste, Karen says.
There are things you don't know.
There are things you don't know, Celeste says.
I tried to make myself love Benji. He's a good person. And I understood it was important to you and Mac that I married someone who could take care of me financially.
Not just financially, Karen says, although she realizes she and Bruce are probably guilty as charged. Benji is strong. He comes from a good family.
His family, Celeste says, isn't what it seems.
Karen gazes out the window at the serene expanse of the Nantucket Harbor. Maybe Celeste already knows that Tag Winbury's mistress has a baby on the way. It makes either perfect sense or no sense at all that a family as wealthy and esteemed as the Winburys have a second narrative running deep underneath the first, like a dark, murky stream. But who is Karen to judge? Only a few hours ago, she feared she had caused Merritt's death. So few families are, Karen says. So few people are. We all have flaws we try to hide, darling. Secrets we try to keep. All of us, Celeste. I made it to the night before the wedding, Celeste says. Before that, I thought if I acted on my true feelings, something bad would happen. Then I told myself that was silly. My actions don't influence the fate of others. But Merritt died. She died nearly as soon as I made the decision. She was the only real true friend I've had in my life, other than you and Mac, and now she's gone forever. Forever, Mama. And it's my fault. I did this to her.
No, Celeste.
Yes, I did, Celeste says.
One way or the other, I did.
Karen watches the tears stream down her daughter's face. Karen is curious, and more than a little alarmed, that Celeste keeps insisting Merritt's death is her fault. Did Celeste do something to her? Did she not do something? It can't be a good idea for Celeste to be carrying on about how it's her fault when the house is crawling with police.
What do you mean by that, darling? Karen asks. Do they know what happened?
I think she took pills, Celeste says.
I think she did it to herself. She was in a bad relationship, a bad situation. And I was emphatic about her breaking it off for good. But she said she couldn't. I found her crying in the rose garden last night.
You did?
She wanted to know why love was so hard for her, why she couldn't get it right. And I hugged her and kissed her and told her it was going to be fine. She just needed to move on. But you know what I should have done? I should have told her that I couldn't get it right either. That love is hard for everybody.
Celeste takes a breath.
I should have told her I didn't love Benji. But I couldn't even say the words in my own mind, much less out loud to another person. She was my best friend, and I didn't tell her.
Oh, honey, Karen says.
Early this morning, I went outside to look at the water one last time, because I knew I was leaving this view behind for good. And I saw something floating.
Celeste, Karen whispers.
It was Merritt,
Celeste says. Karen closes her eyes. They are both quiet. Outside, birds are singing and Karen can hear the gentle lapping of the waves on the Winbury's beach. Celeste says,
I'm not going to marry Benji. I'm going to take a trip. By myself, maybe. Spend some time alone. Try to process what happened.
I think that's wise, darling, Karen says.
Let's go tell your father.
Bruce is still asleep in bed, though his noisy breathing has quieted. His hair is standing on end, his mouth hangs open, and even from so far away, Karen can smell his night-after whiskey breath. His left hand, the one with the wedding band, is resting on his chest, over his heart. Their love is real, Karen thinks. It's strong but flexible. It's unfussy and unvarnished. It has thrived in the modest house on Durhammer Street, in the front seat of their Toyota Corolla, in the routine of their everyday. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, bedtime, repeat, repeat, repeat. It has endured long work weeks, head colds, snowfalls and heat waves, meager pay raises and unexpected bills. It endured the deaths of Karen's parents, Bruce's brother, Bruce's parents, and the smaller losses of Celeste's toads, lizards, and snakes, each of which required a burial. It endured through construction on Route 33, a schoolteacher strike when Celeste was in fourth grade, the Philadelphia Eagles losing season after season after season, despite Bruce's impassioned ranting at the TV, and finally winning it all this past year when, quite frankly, both Bruce and Karen had stopped caring about football. It endured the sad day the Easley family moved away and took their dogs Black Bean and Red Bean, who at the time were Celeste's best friends, with them. It survived the pampered chef parties thrown by women who all secretly thought they were better than Karen. It survived Bruce's bizarre friendship with Robin Swain, and it will survive this tragic weekend. We would go to the post office to mail packages or check our box, and the line was always extra long on Saturdays. But you know what? I didn't care. I could wait an hour. I could wait all day. Because I was with Karen. While Celeste gently jostles Bruce's shoulder to wake him up, Karen slips into the bathroom and locks the door behind her. She opens the third drawer, finds the bottle of pills, picks out the three pearlescent ovoids, and flushes them down the toilet. Karen's pain is gone. She feels stronger than she has in weeks, months even. It makes no sense, and yet it does. Karen can't go anywhere just yet. She needs to see what will happen next. Greer. She catches the chief on his way out of Tag's study. "There's something I think you should know," she says. The chief barely seems to hear her. He's looking at his phone.
"If you'll excuse me," he says.
He reads his screen, then says,
"Your son Thomas is... where? I'll need to talk to him next."
Greer can't believe he's brushing her off. She deliberated about her best course of action. Tell him about the pills or not. Yes, she decided, for a couple of reasons. She will tell him about the pills, and they will finally be able to put all this to rest. "I haven't seen Thomas," Greer says. "But, Chief Kapanash, sir, there's something I must tell you." The chief finally seems to notice her. They are standing in the hallway. God only knows who's listening. Tag is in his study. He might have his ear pressed up against the door. Greer wonders if she should have discussed her decision with him first. He has always been good at seeing a problem from every possible angle and ensuring that a strategy won't backfire. Many times, when Greer needed help with the plot in one of her mysteries, she would consult Tag and he would nearly always come up with a creative answer. Those were some of Greer's favorite moments in her entire marriage, lying in bed with Tag, her head resting in the crook of his arm as she explained her characters and their motivations, while Tag asked provocative questions. He praised her imagination. She gushed over his insightful solutions. Character development required a humanist like Greer, but plotting often benefited from the mind of a mathematician. Greer had felt, in those instances, like part of a team. Oh, how she hates him. For an instant, she wishes she'd married someone mediocre, uninspiring, wealthy and uninspiring. Her third cousin Reggie, for example, posh accent and not an original bone in his body.
"Shall we go into the living room?" Greer asks the chief.
She turns on her heel, not waiting for an answer. The chief follows her into the living room, and Greer closes the door behind him. She doesn't bother with sitting. If she sits, she thinks, she might lose her nerve.
"I forgot to tell the detective something," she says.
The chief's expression hardens into all business. He's not a bad-looking man, Greer thinks. He has a gruffness that she finds sort of appealing, nearly sexy. And he's age-appropriate. This is what Tag has done. Now Greer has to appraise candidates for future romantic interludes. Would the chief be interested in her? Never, she decides. The Greek, maybe, Nick, if he were in the mood for an older woman. Greer flushes, then she notices the chief looking at her expectantly. I didn't forget exactly, Greer says. She wants to clarify this. It's something I only just remembered. The chief nods almost imperceptibly. I went to bed whenever, midnight or so, but I couldn't sleep. I was wound up.
Wound up, the chief says.
Excited about the wedding. I wanted everything to go well, Greer says. So, as I told the detective, I got up and went to the kitchen to pour a glass of champagne.
Yes, the chief says.
Well, what I forgot to tell the detective, meaning what I didn't remember at all until just a little while ago, is that I brought my sleeping pills to the kitchen. My intention was to take a pill with water before I drank my champagne.
What kind of pills were they? The chief asks.
I'd have to call my physician in New York to be sure, Greer says. They're quite potent. Put me to sleep instantly and knock me out for 8 hours straight, which was why, in the end, I decided not to take a pill. I needed to be up early this morning, so I hoped the champagne would do the trick by itself, and that was, in fact, what happened. But when I looked for the pills a few moments ago in my medicine cabinet, where I keep them, they weren't there. And that's when I recalled bringing them to the kitchen. I checked the counter next to the refrigerator, plus every shelf, every drawer, every possible hiding place. I asked my housekeeper, Elida. She hasn't seen them.
Were they in a prescription bottle? The chief asks. Were they marked?
No, Greer says. I have a pill box. It's an enamel box with a painting of Queen Elizabeth on the top.
So who would have known that the pills inside were sleeping pills? The chief asks.
The sleeping pills and the pill box were something of a family joke, Greer says. My husband obviously knew. And the children.
Would Ms. Monaco have known they were sleeping pills? The chief asks.
Greer knows she can't hesitate here, even for a second. Oh, yes, Greer says. I offered Meredith a sleeping pill from the box the last time she stayed with us, in May. This answer wouldn't pass a polygraph, she knows. The truth is that Greer had offered Merritt aspirin for the headache she had after the wine dinner, but never a sleeping pill. So I think we can conclude what happened.
And what's that? The chief says.
Merritt took a sleeping pill, Greer says. The chief says nothing. It's infuriating. The man is impossible to read, even for Greer, who can normally see people's agendas and prevailing emotions as though she were looking into a clear stream. She helped herself to my pills, Greer says. Then she went for a swim, maybe thinking she would cool down before slipping into bed. And the pill knocked her out. It was an accident. The chief pulls out his pad and pencil.
Describe the pill box again, please, Miss Garrison.
He's bought it, she thinks. And relief blows through her like a cool breeze. It's round, about 4 centimeters in diameter, cherry red with a portrait of the queen on the top, she says. The top is hinged. It flips open.
And how many pills inside? The chief asks.
I couldn't say exactly, Greer says. Somewhere between 15 and 25.
The last time you remember seeing the pill box, it was in the kitchen, the chief says. There's no chance you brought it back to your bedroom?
No chance, Greer says. Her nerves return, multiplied, quivering.
So you know there's no chance you brought the pills back to your bedroom, the chief says, and yet you didn't remember bringing the pills into the kitchen when you talked to the detective. I guess I'm questioning how you can be so certain.
I keep the pills in only one place, Greer says, and they weren't there. If I had brought the pills back to my room, they would have been where I always keep them.
No guarantees of that, the chief says.
He clears his throat.
There are a couple of reasons why I don't think Merritt took a pill of her own volition.
Of her own volition, Greer thinks. Oh, dear God.
They'll suspect Tag of drugging the girl, of course. Or they'll suspect Greer herself.
But wait, Greer says.
The chief turns away.
Thank you for the information, he says. Now I'm going to find your son, Thomas.
Tuesday, July 3rd to Friday, July 6th, 2018. Celeste. Tuesday at work, she makes a list of things that might take the place of love. Security, financial. Security, emotional. Apartment. After the honeymoon, Celeste is moving into Benji's apartment in Tribeca. Together, they surveyed Celeste's studio to see what would make the trip downtown. Not her futon, not her yard sale furniture, none of her dishes or pots and pans, not her shower curtain or bathroom rug, not the pair of mason jar lamps filled with beans. When Celeste said that she wanted to bring the rainbow candles her mother made, Benji said, "Just bring the candle Abby gave you if you want a candle." The candle he was referring to was a Jo Malone pine and eucalyptus luxury candle that Abby gave Celeste as an engagement present. Celeste does love the way it smells, but once she found out how much it cost, she knew she could never, ever light it. Celeste immediately decided she would bring her mother's candles, despite Benji's obvious opinion that they weren't as good as a department store candle. Celeste would set them on the mantle. Benji told Celeste that he contacted a real estate agent at Sotheby's, who is searching for a brownstone on East 78th Street, specifically on the block between Park and Lexington. Celeste tries to imagine herself living on that block, owning a home on that block. Would that be as good as love? Shooter has the condo in Hell's Kitchen. The condo has nothing in it but a mattress and a TV, Benji has told her. Shooter is never there. Family. Tag, Greer, Thomas, Abby, Abby's future baby, assorted aunts, uncles, and cousins in England. Shooter has even less family than Celeste. Shooter has no one. Nantucket. This is, perhaps, the strongest competition for love. Because Celeste has never felt about a place the way she feels about Nantucket. She tries to ignore that her most romantic storybook times there have been with Shooter. She could easily go to the chicken box with Benji. She could take Benji out to Smith's Point and show him the natural water slide. On Nantucket, she will always have a beach to walk on, a path to run, a farm to provide heirloom tomatoes and corn on the cob, a boat to putter around the harbor in, cobblestone streets to stroll in the evenings. Celeste yearns to experience Nantucket at every time of year. She wants to go to the Daffodil Festival in the spring, wear a yellow sweater, make a picnic of cold roast chicken and deviled eggs and asparagus salad, and cheer as the antique car parade passes by. She wants to go in the fall when the leaves change and the cranberries are harvested, and the high school football team is playing at home. She wants to go at Thanksgiving, swim in the turkey plunge, watch the tree lighting on Friday night, eat scallops just harvested from the sound. She wants to go in the dead of winter during a blizzard, when Main Street is blanketed with snow and not a soul is stirring. Shooter won't be able to give her Nantucket the way that Benji can. Celeste can't come up with anything else, so she rolls back up to security, financial. Celeste will have health insurance. Celeste will be able to shop for groceries at Zabar's, Fairway, Dean and DeLuca. She will be able to buy expensive salads, bouquets of fresh flowers, every day if she wants. Orchids if she wants. Boxes of macarons, bottles of Veuve Clicquot, cases of Veuve Clicquot. She will be able to buy hardcover books the day they come out and get orchestra seats for the theater. They'll be able to take trips, to London certainly, but also to Paris, Rome, Shanghai, Sydney. They'll be able to go on safari in Africa, maybe even hike to see the silverback gorillas in Uganda, a dream so far-fetched that Celeste has put it in the same category as space travel. She will shop with Merritt at opening ceremony, at Topshop, at Intermix. She'll try things on without checking the price tag. It's inconceivable. It doesn't seem real.
How will it work?
Celeste asked Benji.
Money, I mean. Once we're married?
I'll put your name on my accounts, Benji said. We'll get you an ATM card, a checkbook. Once I turn 35, I'll have access to the trust from my Garrison grandparents, so there will be that money as well.
Celeste has wondered since then how much money is in the Garrison trust. $1 million? $5 million? $20 million? What is the amount that takes the place of love?
What about my salary?
Celeste had asked. Keep it for yourself, Benji said. Celeste earns $62,000 a year, but Benji makes that sound like a quarter she found on the sidewalk. She supposes that, to him, it is. Celeste's assistant, Bethany, walks into her office without knocking, and Celeste scrambles to hide the list. What would Bethany think if she saw it? What kind of woman has to make a list of reasons she's happy to be marrying Benjamin Winbury?
Celeste? Bethany says.
Her expression is uneasy, as though she suspects she interrupted something.
Hmm?
Celeste says.
Zed wants to see you in the conference room, Bethany says.
Conference room? Celeste says. She was supposed to meet with Zed in his office because tomorrow starts a 2.5-week vacation that includes her wedding and honeymoon, and she needs to delegate the work on her desk. Bethany shrugs.
That's what he said.
The door to the conference room is closed, and when Celeste swings the door open, she sees a dozen golden balloons and, in the center of the table, a round bakery cake ringed with icing flowers and the words, Congrats, Celeste. A cheer goes up, and Celeste looks around at her zoo colleagues. Donner, Carsong, Darius, Mawabe, Vern, even Blair from Reptiles. Celeste tears up. A shower. Her co-workers have thrown her a bridal shower, complete with balloons, cake, a few bags of chips, and a wrapped present. Celeste can't believe it. This isn't that kind of office, and these aren't those kind of co-workers. They obviously know Celeste is getting married, and she knows that Blair feels her long-ago migraine was responsible for Celeste and Benji meeting in the first place. Three of Celeste's co-workers are actually making the trip to Nantucket, Bethany, Mawabe, and Vern, but because it's the 4th of July week, all of the reasonably priced hotels were sold out, so the three of them are arriving Saturday at noon and leaving on the 9:30 fast boat. Celeste is touched that the three of them are making the trip. To drive from the city and take the boat requires more effort than she'd thought they'd make, but Celeste is also a bit nervous about their arrival. Benji exacerbated Celeste's concern when he said, I can't imagine Mawabe and Vern in the same room as my mother. Although Benji's sentiment echoed Celeste's own feelings, she took umbrage.
Why not? She said. It would be good for your mother to realize people like Mawabe exist. I'm just sorry Blair isn't coming.
She paused.
Bethany is normal. Sort of.
Sort of, Benji conceded. Now, Bethany comes forward holding out the gift. Celeste assumes Bethany selected the gift and everyone else chipped in, but some people, like Darius, probably have yet to pay their share.
What could it be?
Celeste asks. She unwraps the box and lifts off the top to find a simple white apron with Mrs. Winbury embroidered in black on the front. Mrs. Winbury. Celeste's heart sinks.
I love it, she says.
Her stutter is so debilitating and so unpredictable that she and Benji have had to tailor their wedding vows with Reverend Derby so that all Celeste has to say is, I do. But even those two words present a challenge. It's Wednesday, the 4th of July. Benji and Shooter, Thomas and Abby, and Tag and Greer are already up on Nantucket. But Celeste had to work through Tuesday, and Merritt has a can't-miss fireworks party tonight. Celeste's parents aren't due to arrive until Friday. Celeste decides she will fly to Boston with Merritt on Thursday morning, and then Uber to the Cape and take the fast ferry across to Nantucket. Celeste calls Merritt at 3 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon.
I can't do it, she says.
What? Merritt says.
What do you mean?
What does she mean? She means she can't marry Benji. She knows she's making a mistake. She's in love with Shooter. It's a physical condition, an affliction. It is, as Merritt said, in her blood. Celeste feels like she's standing on a cliff. If Shooter were here right now by her side, willing to hold her hand and never let go, she would jump. But he's not. He's on Nantucket, executing the best man duties with his usual flair.
I can't say my vows, Celeste says.
She can't force it out. Stutter is, ironically, the hardest word. I'll be right there, Merritt says. Merritt stands before Celeste and says, Do you, Celeste Marie Otis, take Benjamin Garrison Winbury to be your lawfully wedded husband, to have and to hold, to bug and to pester, to scream at and screw, until death do you part? Celeste smiles. Say it, Merritt says.
I do, Celeste says.
She winces.
Pretend it's a different word, Merritt says. Pretend it's due like on a leaf in the morning, or due like your rent. I think you're just psyching yourself out.
Due, like on a leaf in the morning, Celeste thinks.
I do, she says.
The corners of Merritt's mouth lift. Again, she says.
I do, Celeste says.
I mean, I do.
Just like that, Merritt says.
She glances at her phone. I have to go. We'll practice more tomorrow. And Friday.
Okay,
Celeste says.
Merritt?
Merritt holds up a hand. You don't have to thank me, she says. You're my best friend. I'm your maid of honor.
No, Celeste says. I mean, yes, thank you. But what I want to know is, did you end things with Tag?
No, Merritt says. He ended things with me. Once Celeste is on Nantucket, she becomes a marionette operated by Greer and Roger Pelton, the wedding planner. Roger is like a kind and supremely capable uncle. He goes over the 3-day schedule with Celeste, where she needs to be, what she needs to do, what she will be wearing. The outfits are lined up in the closet. Thursday afternoon, Greer has scheduled Celeste for a massage, a mani-pedi, and an eyelash extension.
Eyelash extension? Celeste says. Is that necessary?
No, Roger says. I'll call R.J. Miller and cancel that part of the appointment.
Thank you, Celeste says.
The most important part of my job, Roger says, is protecting my brides from their mothers and mothers-in-law. Celeste loves how Roger refers to her as my bride. She pretends she's marrying Roger, and this lightens her mood. Temporarily. Celeste keeps one eye trained on Shooter at all times, like she's a spy or a sniper. Their gazes meet and lock, and Celeste dissolves inside. He's trying to tell her something without speaking. But what? Celeste craves the looks, even though they're ruining her. When Shooter isn't looking at her, when he's joking with Merritt or Abby or Greer, she feels sickeningly jealous. Celeste's parents arrive. Celeste worries that, like Benji, the Winburys will think Karen and Bruce are the salt of the earth and will patronize them, possibly without their even realizing it. But Greer is fine with Celeste's parents, and Tag is better than fine. Celeste wants to hold a grudge against Tag, but he is so gracious and charming with her parents that she can feel only gratitude toward him. She'll confront her anger and disappointment later, after the wedding. The rehearsal dinner unfolds exactly as it should. Other people are drinking the blackberry mojito punch. Celeste has one sip of Benji's and decides to stick to white wine. She doesn't have time to keep track of Shooter. She's too busy meeting this person and that person. A friend of Tag and Greer's from London named Featherly. A business associate of Tag's named Peter Walls. Neighbors from London, neighbors from New York. Benji's lacrosse coach from St. George's. And the four Alexanders. Blonde and preppy Alexander, Asian Alexander, Jewish Alexander, who is engaged to a black woman named Mimi, who is a Broadway dancer, and the Alexander known as Xander, who is married to a man named Kermit. Celeste feared her parents would be shy and overwhelmed, but they are holding their own, and Betty looks better than Celeste anticipated. She walks with a cane, and Celeste knows she's on a mighty dose of painkillers, but she appears happy, nearly radiant. She is far happier about this wedding than Celeste is. Celeste makes a deal with God. I will go through with this if you just please keep my mother alive. There are past hors d'oeuvres, each one more creative and delicious looking than the next, although Celeste is far too anxious to eat. She sips her wine, but it has little effect. Her body is numb. The only thing that matters is Shooter. Where is Shooter? She can't find him. Then he will appear, brushing past her elbow. Even the slightest touch lights her up. She has thought back on the kissing in her apartment only a few thousand times since it happened. How did she have the willpower to refuse him? She is in awe of herself. Her father stands to give a toast. It's about Betty first, and Celeste's eyes well with tears. Then it's about Celeste, and Bruce says, "And so to you, Benjamin Winbury. I say from the heart, take care of our little girl. She is our treasure, our hope, our light, and our warmth. She is our legacy. Here's to the two of you and your life together." And everyone clinks glasses and drinks. Thomas stands to speak next, and Celeste leans over to Benji and says, "I thought Shooter was giving the toast." "He didn't want to," Benji says. "What?" Celeste says. "He told me he didn't want to speak tonight," Benji says. "He'll give a toast tomorrow, after we're married." "Tomorrow," Celeste thinks. "After we're married." Celeste doesn't want to go out. She has done enough pretending for one night. She wants to go to bed. Honestly, she would like to sleep as she did when she was a child, right between Mac and Betty. Her mother senses something is wrong. Celeste can tell by the emphatic way Betty insists that Celeste go out to be with her friends, be with Benji. "I'll be with Benji the rest of my life," Celeste thinks. Her time with her mother is dwindling. The sand is running through the hourglass more quickly now, at the end. But Celeste knows her mother will be happier if she goes out. Besides, Shooter is going. And Merritt. Celeste needs to keep an eye on Merritt. However, when they are all piling into cars, Merritt is missing. "Wait a minute," Celeste says. She climbs out of the Winbury's Land Rover and runs across the driveway to the second cottage. She pokes her head in, but the lights are off. Merritt isn't there. "Celeste," Benji says, "come on." "I have to find Merritt," she says. She tries to remember the last time she saw Merritt. It was during the dinner, obviously, but Celeste had to meet and mingle with so many people that she didn't get to spend any time with her one true friend. And Merritt didn't give a toast, even though she'd intimated that she might. "Please," Celeste thinks, "don't let her be with Tag." But that has to be it. Where else could she be? She is always the one leading the charge when it comes to continuing the fun. Celeste tears through the house, checking each room, the kitchen, the formal dining room, the casual dining room, the powder room, even the glowing cube that is the wine cellar. She goes down the hall and checks the alcove outside Greer and Tag's room, but she doesn't have the courage to knock on their bedroom door or on the door to Tag's study. She scurries down to poke her head into the white living room, even though she has never once set foot in there. She sees a figure in one of the chairs, and she's so startled she cries out.
"It's just me," someone with a British accent says.
It's that Featherly woman.
"Are you looking for someone?"
"My friend Merritt," Celeste says. "Maid of honor? Black dress?"
"If you bring me a bottle of whiskey, I'll tell you where she is."
"Excuse me?" Celeste says. She has been told that Featherly is an old friend of the family, but Celeste can't imagine Greer abiding this kind of rudeness.
"Have you seen Merritt? I'm sorry, I need to find her."
"I'm the one who's sorry, love," Featherly says. "I noticed her earlier. Quite an attractive girl, but I haven't seen her in hours."
"Okay, thank you," Celeste says, hoping she doesn't now seem rude by rushing out. What is Featherly doing in the living room anyway? Certainly Greer didn't offer to let her sleep there. Celeste sails through the laundry room and out the side door, hurrying toward the pool house. She hears coughing and can just barely make out the shadow of a figure bent over in the rose garden. It's Merritt.
"Merritt!" Celeste says.
She crosses the arched footbridge over the koi pond into the rose garden. Merritt is spitting into the grass.
"Are you sick?"
Merritt straightens up and wipes her mouth. There are tears running down her face.
"The oysters aren't agreeing with me."
Celeste reaches out to embrace her friend.
"You poor thing," she says. "Let me walk you back to your cottage. I'm going to tell the rest of them to go to town without me. I didn't want to go anyway."
"No," Merritt says. "No, you go, please. Or I'll feel guilty. I just need some air."
She tries to smile at Celeste, but then she starts crying again.
"Only I could mess up a gorgeous night like this."
"Stop it," Celeste says. "Weddings are stressful."
"Especially this one," Merritt says.
She holds out her left hand.
"You see this ring?"
Merritt points to a silver band on her thumb.
"He gave me this for my birthday."
"Tack did?" Celeste whispers. She takes hold of Merritt's hand and studies the ring. It's set with tiny multicolored stones. It's very pretty, but Merritt has a lot of cool jewelry, some of it given to her for free by various fashion labels.
"It's a ring," Merritt says. "He could have given me anything for my birthday. A book, a scarf, a bracelet. But he gave me a ring."
"Yes, well..." Celeste is pretty sure Tag meant the ring to be a token of his fondness, nothing more. But he might have chosen something a little less emotionally charged. Just then, Celeste hears the Land Rover's horn and knows Benji is losing patience. She has been gone much longer than she intended.
"I love you. You know that, right? And when you leave here Sunday, you never have to see Tag Winbury again. I promise I won't make you attend any family functions."
"I wish it were that easy," Merritt says. She takes an exaggerated breath.
"There's something I have to tell you."
The car horn sounds again. Celeste feels annoyed at Benji's impatience, but she knows he has a caravan of people waiting on her.
"I have to scoot," she says. "Come with us."
"I can't," Merritt says. "I don't feel well. I'm just going to hang around here. Maybe go to bed."
"Before midnight?" Celeste says. "That would be a first."
She gives Merritt another hug.
"Tomorrow we'll find time to talk, I promise. I don't care if a church full of people have to wait."
Merritt gives a small laugh. "Okay." They are a party of 12, and town is crowded with holiday revelers. There's a line to get into the boarding house. The Pearl is at maximum capacity, as is Nautilus. The club car piano bar is an option, but Thomas announces that one ends at the club car, one never starts there. Asian Alexander's wife is wearing stilettos and doesn't want to risk walking down to Straight War for crew. Celeste looks to Benji, waiting for him to make an executive decision. As it is, they are spilling off the corner of India and Federal into the street.
"Let's go to the back bar at Ventuno," he says.
Everyone agrees. It's nearby, it's open air. They'll go for one drink, then reassess. Somehow Celeste gets sifted to the back of the group, probably because she's literally dragging her feet. She doesn't see the point of yelling.